Accession number 17117, Reel 1.
Mr. Croker, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
In Plymouth and Devon.
Which year was this?
That would be on the 9th of August, 1920.
Were you educated in Plymouth?
Yes, I went to the local, as then of course, state school, and I was a scholarship boy and got through to Denport High School.
That was a grammar school, was it?
A grammar school, yes.
How old were you when you left there?
And I left there at 16 to join the Navy to become an artificer apprentice in Chatham.
Why did you want to join the Navy in the first place?
Because I couldn't see myself getting a credit in Latin. Because at that time, school certificate meant that you had to have English, maths, a classical language, which was either Latin or Greek. And one way out, of course, being a naval port. My uncle has been in the Navy and a long family tradition of Navy. And so off I went.
Where did you do your first training?
In Chatham, and that was until 1939 when the war broke out. The training initially was to be 4.5 years in Chatham, but we were then moved to Devonport because of the fear that Chatham and, in fact, all towns to London would be bombed to the ground. Of course, this was following the attack on Poland, and we were moved to Plymouth, and we spent the rest of our training there until June 1940.
What did you think of the training that you got pre-war?
Oh, that was excellent.
Did you think that a war was coming?
Yes, I think most people knew that one only had to look at the press, and we were involved, of course, in the Munich affair in Chatham, in so much as we had to assist in the mobilisation of reservists.
How did you feel then when you heard, if you heard, Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I must confess that it was rather a funny feeling, in that things are certainly going to change and life was never going to be the same again, because when we were apprentices, we worked hard, we were schooling 3 days, 3 nights a week after hard days in factory, but we also had tons of sports and that sort of thing, and life was a very stable and very, shall we say, it went to very much to a routine. But with war now being declared, then of course that was the uncertainty ahead.
Were you in any of the early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
Only one or two random raids in Plymouth where occasional bombs were dropped, and indeed one was dropped in our own front garden at home. So
what was your address then?
In Peveril in Plymouth, and it was a random raid, and my mother had always been on to me about cutting down a little palm tree we had in the front garden, and I'd cut this thing down when I was on leave, which pleased her. But of course the worst thing was having to dig out this great big root, and Hitler finished the job for me. The bomb fell quite square right on top of this root and cleared the whole thing right out. Great big bomb crater in the garden.
Which street in Peveril was this?
In Leet Walk in Peveril.
You remember the number?
Yes, number 5.
But this wasn't the really heavy raids on Plymouth?
No, those came later. And those came when, in fact, I was in the Prince of Wales, and that came in early 41.
Was the Prince of Wales the first ship you went to sea in?
Yes.
Can you tell me about joining the ship? What do you remember of that, please?
That was a little traumatic, in so much that I stood by the ship for about 3 weeks. In the final part of our course in Devonport, we had a very intensive course of 6 months on gunnery and material, because my function was maintenance of all gunnery material, all the machinery and that sort of thing. And so we went then, the four of us had gained ourselves 6 months advancement in promotion. And of course we, I suppose, were favoured to be joining a big capital ship, new off the stocks, that sort of thing. So 3 weeks before the Prince of Wales was finally completed, we went to Birkenhead and we stayed in digs, and we were looked after very well by our landlady, and we went down to the ship, and we went around the ship, and we saw the space in the ship, and it seemed quite all right, our mess, large mess and that sort of thing. But when we came to join it, we joined it in a snowstorm. We were late, the four of us, in that we were knee-deep in snow. There were no, obviously, buses running. We were some way out of Birkenhead, just beyond Tranmere, and I can remember sliding on our suitcases down to the Camel Laird shipyard to the ship. And when we arrived, we were late. Nothing was said, of course, of the conditions. The commissioning ceremony, the little one they'd had, was completed. But I can remember going down to the mess and then finding everyone in the mess, and we had 32 in that mess, and it was not as big as then one had anticipated. And my locker, being a very young, raw, as it were, new to sea on this thing, I found was a locker in the corner in which I had to stow everything. And this is when life began then to catch up with me, because here it was a locker which, oh dear, we've got to think in terms of feet. I suppose the thing couldn't have been any more than 3 foot high and about, well, there we are, we're looking about 2 feet wide. And you had to store everything but everything in there. And then we found the bathroom was some way from the mess we were in. And to go to the heads, that's the loo, of course, you had to walk a further, well, quite as far as from here, out to the front of the road, so you can see how far that is. And I mean, you're going quite some distance. Mind you, we were quite well off when one bears in mind there were chiefs and chief petty officers and petty officers in this mess. But I did feel then, and this is when I started to see the conditions which the seamen, as it were, had to, and I say endure in that ship, in so much outside our mess was a rather a narrow passage in which there were similar lockers for the seamen, and they had to use that with everyone passing by, and there was a lot of ducking and weaving if a chappie was changing to go ashore. And indeed, when it was sleeping at night, he was slinging his hammock there so that people would bump under the hammock. So here, when I say about the traumatic experience of joining the ship, that was where the trauma lie, in that here all the comforts of home had suddenly dissipated and you were back to reality of the steel box. And of course then in building, when we were standing by, I saw how much the room that the Admiral and all the rest of the people back aft enjoyed. And of course this then started the mind ticking. And indeed, if I may continue on that theme, up the gangway should come two sub-lieutenants N.E. who were at school with me and who'd stayed on at school. And here I was, of course, as I'd left at 16 and they'd stayed on and they'd gone down to the Royal Engineering College at Keom. But of course, one must bear in mind the social conditions of that time. My father was a shunter on the railway, and that was it. There was no way that I could possibly have gone to Keom. But that, of course, again, were part of the trauma.
Were you happy aboard the ship?
Not particularly. I'm afraid that the ship was not a particularly happy ship, in so much as I've said now about the space and the room. But I'm thinking from my own point of view and our fellow OAs in particular in that ship, because that ship had new 14-inch guns, and I, after a spell in the workshop, doing a stint in the workshop, was given to take charge of two 5.25 turrets on there, and I had to look after the machinery in these. And of course this was not out of the way. I mean, this is what one expected. But the fact that all this was new equipment and it kept breaking down, we would be spending quite easily. I mean, at some periods we were doing three all night a week working and worked during the day as well. And indeed in the Bismarck's episode, as you've no doubt read, we had dockyard people aboard that ship when we went to sea for the Bismarck. Three we had in our mess, three Vickers men, and one in the wardroom, a manager. So it was the general work that you were working. You were always, you know, up to your eyeballs in oil, and when it came, of course, into the mess, and you had to go down that bathroom and back up again, all this kind of thing, you know, it's not a particularly happy ship.
Was that typical of new ships, or was this a special problem with the Prince of Wales?
I think it was special for the Prince of Wales, that the working up period was one in which, you know, people were very tired, and of course, as you've probably read in the book Battleship, the ventilation was poor on that ship, because down in the workshop, and you could work down in the lower parts of the shell hoist, and the air down there was very still and very, you know, enervating, I would say.
Do you remember any of the specific problems that you personally were dealing with?
In the machinery? Well, there were two main. One we had a great deal of trouble with the hoist, the shell hoist. And this mainly occurred, and probably you've seen in the book the picture of the 525 turret of the gunhouse of that. They were quite cramped, and they were very, very good in machinery space. But of course, you tended to get bits of waste, drop down hoist, and pawls. That's the little thing on which lifts the shell up, would be in fact here jammed. And of course, you were taking hoist apart and this sort of thing. And indeed the worst job we had was just in fact before we were sunk. We had left Cape Town and we were crossing the Indian Ocean, and I had a pump, one of the hydraulic pumps, in the P4 turret. In fact, we had to replace the pump, because one of the problems with this, that and I of course this seems we're getting in terribly technical on this, but when we closed up at action stations, and there's always dawn and dusk action stations, obviously during the wartime situation, you had to make sure you got there fairly smartly before any guns crew got there, because one dare not start any of the hydraulic pump that is supplying all the hydraulic power to the turret. You don't start that hydraulic pump with the bypass valve closed on this. This is a bypass where the pump used to start and then build up its pressure, and the pressure was quite I mean, here you're looking at 1,000 pounds plus a square inch of oil, and that pressure then had to be built up before this bypass valve was closed, and then of course the pump, the turret would be then ready to be working. But if of course the pump was started by any member of the crew with that bypass valve closed, the excess pressure built up in the pump, and of course there was a danger of cracking casings and this sort of thing. And we had in fact one go in the Indian Ocean on the way to Colombo, and that was in my turret, and we had to replace that, and that meant that we were working 4 hours on and 4 hours off, because there were 4 OAs on 525 turrets. There were 8 525 turrets on there, and 1 OA to 2 turrets. So we all had to dig in and two on, working on the pump, and two would just lie down and rest on the steel plate, you see, for 4 hours, and then get up and relieve the other two. Because this pump, by the way, was quite well, I forget how many, but it was well over a ton in weight, and you had to have special lifting gear on this thing, because you had to take all the hydraulic pipes away surrounding it so that you could get at it. It was rather like opening up one's intestines and getting all the intestines out before you could actually get to the backbone, if you know what I mean. And then you had to do this and then sling it down on special slings and ship the new one. And this took 3 days to do this, so 4 hours on and 4 off working on that. And that was the first one. And then after we left Colombo, we had another one went, and that went in P1. And we only carried two spares, incidentally, on this. And that pump went, and of course, having had the experience on mine in P4, we were able to get that done rather quicker in just over then the 2 days. But it was 4 on and 4 off the same. So that we just finished that job as we tied up alongside the wall in Singapore, and we just managed to get ashore for a pint up in the canteen, you know, that night. I'll never forget that. But anyway, that was so we had quite a bit that went wrong.
What about relations between officers and men in the ship, as far as being happy aboard ship was concerned?
Oh, very. As far as I was concerned, that was quite good. I had no problem on that, because we had a very good ordnance lieutenant on there, and he's an older chap here, and that was very, very good. There was no problem on that line as far as our department went.
Now, obviously, the pursuit of the Bismarck was in May. Did anything happen between commissioning the ship and May, as far as you were concerned, that you'd like to recall?
Well, before the Bismarck thing, well, yes, we were doing our usual workup routine out of Scapa Flow, shipping subcaliber guns inside the main ones, whereby you fire small two-pounders, and that was to be expected. And, of course, we went to sea with the hood, and... well, of course, that's well documented. I did have an 8-inch shell come in my turret and went all the way around and landed up on the deck and didn't explode, thank heaven, otherwise we'd be here. But
can you take me through the Bismarck pursuit as you remember it, and what happened to you step by step, please?
Yes, I can remember that quite clearly, because this was my first blooding, as it were, my first taste of action. And of course, we were all on top line in our turrets, and everything had been done that we could possibly do. And I remember being told that we must go to the messes. We stood down from action stations, and I can remember lying on the lockers on a cushion and hearing the sea pounding outside, because it was quite half a gale blowing we were steaming into. And of course, we couldn't sleep, apart from the fact that you know, there's a feeling of general tension in the ship. But every now and again, we had an air artificer in our base would come into the mess and try to get his head down, and of course the phone would go, because we had a phone in the mess, calling him back again, because they were fueling and defueling our aircraft. And the admiral in the hood couldn't make up his mind whether he wanted the aircraft for spotting purposes next day in the battle which was to come or not. So when it came to here at 5:30 in the morning, when we were then closed up, in fact, because here is getting light and we are about now to join battle with the Bismarck, we had an aircraft not fully fueled. So we closed up at action stations feeling very, very tired. And I can remember we closed up and feeling, but of course the tiredness was somewhat dispelled because, of course, the adrenaline was starting to run. And I can remember standing looking at the aircraft with the pilot getting in it, because these people were going to be shot off and no hopes of picking them up, because they were going to go off and spot the fall of shot on the Bismarck, but there's no way that we were going to be able to pick them up in any battle. And it was blowing quite a gale, quite a sea running. And I remember watching this, and the torpedo officer used to wave his red and green flags. And of course the Bismarck then opened fire, and of course everybody shot for cover. Oh, before that, I forgot, I must mention this, we streamed the biggest ensign I've ever seen in my life, and the padre had a prayer, and it was so that we're doing this very much a la Henry V in Shakespeare, if you like, and so there was no uncertain terms who we were and what we were about to do. But of course the Bismarck, I suppose, and played cricket so much in Germany, started and of course the whole thing commenced, and the pilot hopped out of his aircraft and the observer smartly, we hopped in our turrets, but we were in P3 on the port side. We were on what we call the disengaged side, and we just got in and closed down all the hatches and that sort of thing, and the 525s in fact opened fire first. But in, I went down into the working chamber, and in fact the chamber where the shells come up from the shell room and the magazines before going into the working chamber. And I walked around the working chamber and looked out through a little, they had an aperture where one threw spent cases over the sea if they should jam up in the turret. And I looked towards the hood and could do this, and we started. And the first rounds from Bismarck seemed, in fact, to come, I thought, rather nearer us than to the hood. And then a fire started on the boat deck of the hood. They hit the hood. And then, quite frankly, I can't... It is... The more I think of it, I thought of this, and ever since this, I could hear no bang, no sound whatever. There was just a... And I don't know if you've seen the Barham blown up on the North Africa, the explosion of the Barham when she was torpedoed. But there's something akin to that. There's a great, like a glow and a mass of smoke, and the bows came out, and as it came out, the forward, two of the forward guns seemed to fire the hood, and that was it. The forecastle went round into the sea. And as I said, there was quite a gale blowing. And it was quite soon when the smoke cleared above the sea, you know, as you when one's trying to lay a smoke screen as a destroyer, it rises quickly off the sea, and you could just see the wash, and there was nothing there. And there was that sudden feeling of the shock was, it was, you know, unbelievable. Here I am, being brought up in, as an apprentice from 16, in the might of the Royal Navy. In the hood had always been the epitome of all that was great in the British Navy, and there it was, gone, nothing. And I walked back then around the working chamber out into this hoist space, the machinery space, and leaned on an air bottle which we use for blowing fumes out through the guns when we fire in the turret. Otherwise fumes, of course cordite fumes, would impair the guns crew. And I leaned on this bottle. Incidentally, it had 4,000 pounds per square inch of air in there. And I was there with an LTO, a leading torpedo operator, and the second captain of the turret, a leading seaman whose name I forget. He was the three badge chappie back. This chappie used to go to action stations without his teeth in his head. Oh, I'll come to that. But couldn't believe this at all, and we started to discuss this, and then suddenly there was a great flash and a bang, and all the lights went out, and there was then followed by that silence of almost the tinkle tinkle, as it were, of things just falling about. And of course I won't say what the first expressions were, but the lights were still on in the working chamber. And I turned here, and a small fire seemed to be starting. And of course, you must bear in mind that because we were here closed up for action stations, we were loaded with cordite and shells in the compartment, armor-piercing shells. And this fire had started, but it turned out to be in the wardroom heads across the passageway. But that was soon put out. And I had a torch in my overalls and pulled the torch out and thought, because one of the crew, one of the boys, and they were mainly boys manning the 525s, complained that he couldn't get his ammunition around, couldn't see in the dark. And there's something happening, Chief, you see. They called me Chief. I was a PO at that time. And I went to walk forward, put my torch out, went to walk forward, and there was this oil drum which we used for topping up the hydraulic system, because it was oil system in the turret. This thing had a great hole in it, was just rolling around, and there's oil slopping all over the deck here. And when I put the drum to one side, there was this great glistening 8-inch shell. And I must confess that was shot number two. And I went into the working chamber where there's a voice pipe and called up to the captain of the turret, a petty officer by name of Holt. First thing I'd said to this three-badge leading seaman, come on, we can't stay here, we want to get rid of this thing, to which he would have nothing to do with this at all. So I called up to the PO, captain of the turret. He said, I thought we'd had a, in his exact words, I thought we had a brick aboard, because sparks came up the hoist, you see. So he came down then from the gunhouse and came down the small hatch. And we took one look at this shell, and I said, you know, I think we'd better get this thing overboard, to which he agreed. He got hold of the nose of this thing, and I got hold of the base. And as I got hold of the base, it was loose, the bottom of it, where the primer is. And I thought, and I waggled it a bit, and it fell off. And I thought to myself, looked at it, and I thought, shone a torch on it, and I thought, that's a beautiful souvenir of that, and put that to one side. But I put my arm up inside the shell, and it went quite some way up, and it was empty. But there was still unaccounted amount up in the nose, and we still decided no. But the funny thing is that this leading seaman, this pensioner that he'd been called back, he was over this thing like that, saying, look here, I'm having nothing to do with this. If that thing goes off, and he was standing right by us. But this chap, incidentally, one must again remember that he took his teeth out, because you had to pay for false teeth before the war. People forget this kind of, again, going back to our social condition. So his teeth, he had to pay quite a bit of his pay for these teeth, and he used to put these in his ditty box before he went to action stations. But I'll never forget his standing there. I remember his name now, perhaps I may not say it, but he said, I've nothing to do with this. But anyway, we got hold of the shell, took it out, and threw it over the side. And we had a mild wigging from the gunnery officer afterwards for doing this when we got back into Rosyth on this. But that shell came in the turret, and we traced it around, and where we were standing on the air bottle, or I was standing, leaning on the air bottle, as that shell came through behind me, it was a neat hole, and it hit the angle iron, if you like, if you've got angle iron like that, and its point of the shell was to the left of the angle, so that the what is called the radius curvature head caught on the metal and deflected it. And I was able to...